Good morning. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and this is Talk Radio. Is there an irrational prejudice against Muslims in the United States? John Pfeffer is the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and he writes its regular Worldbeat column. He'll be publishing a book on Islamophobia in 2011. And John, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So there was an article recently in the LA Times that argues that there isn't a backlash against Muslims, because if you look at the number of anti-Islamic hate crimes, the rate is actually pretty low. What do you think about that?
If you look at the FBI figures, it's true that the we have to recognize the FBI figures have not been updated for the last couple of years, but there was a decline from 2001, which was a spike after 9/11 in anti-Muslim hate crimes, and there was a gradual decline from that period until about 2007. We don't have the official FBI figures for 2008-2009, but we do have some other figures that suggest that, in fact, anti-Muslim hate crimes and anti-Muslim hate rhetoric have increased sharply over the last 2 years. We should recognize that another kind of element of that argument is that anti-Semitic hate crimes and rhetoric have always consistently been larger than anti-Muslim hate crimes and here in the United States, and that is very true. But that doesn't really undercut the argument that we are experiencing a very strong Islamophobia here, and it has a very strong political element that isn't captured in these figures around hate crimes and anti-Muslim rhetoric.
Okay, if you have an opinion about whether the Muslims are being unfairly targeted, give us a call, 503-231-8187. Well, I think it's interesting that if you look at the FBI figures, the incidence of anti-Muslim hate crimes is pretty low. But if you start looking, counting in the official government harassment of Muslims, all of a sudden the picture looks very different, because the U.S. has been targeting Muslims since 9/11.
That's correct. And there are two dimensions to this, of course. There's the dimension domestically and the dimension internationally. But basically, since 9/11, the U.S. government has essentially embraced a kind of racial profiling, a belief that American Muslims and Muslims in general are predisposed toward terrorism or violence, and that the U.S. government should take actions accordingly. We have arrested tens of thousands of people, and after this concerted campaign after 9/11, it netted almost nothing in terms of real plots. But there's also the international dimension, and here I think, you know, we try to understand, well, why is there such a strong anti-American sentiment in majority Muslim countries around the world? Of course, during the Bush years, the years of the George W. Bush administration, the argument was made, well, you know, we're fighting wars in Muslim-majority countries in Iraq and Afghanistan. That explains the plummeting of U.S. image in those countries. But with the election of Barack Obama, there was an expectation that that anti-American sentiment would largely dissipate. The president promised to end the war in Iraq. He made a very important speech in Egypt talking about engagement with the Muslim world. And yet still, in fact, the U.S. image in the Muslim world is very low and has gone down in the last year. In Pakistan, for instance, U.S. image was considered positive by only about 13% of the population in 2008. And in 2009, it went down to 8%.
Do you think that has something to do with the fact that we've been dropping bombs on people in Pakistan?
I think it does. I think it does. And in fact, the Obama administration has increased the number of drone attacks in Pakistan. It, of course, orchestrated a surge in Afghanistan. It has expanded special forces operations from about 60 countries during the Bush years to about 75 countries today, and many of those countries are Muslim majority or have significant Muslim minorities. So from the perspective of the Muslim world, things haven't gotten any better. In fact, things have gotten worse, which I think explains why there's still a kind of anti-American animus.
Well, let's take the example of Pakistan and the drone attacks. The way that it's reported in the United States, you would think that they're attacking nothing but nests of al-Qaeda. But when you look at the statistics of who's actually killed, I think it's something in the order of 80% of the people killed by these drone attacks are perfectly innocent civilians.
That's correct. It's very difficult to get exact figures, but one estimate by a couple people who are following this issue closely was that 50 civilians are killed for every one Taliban leader or al-Qaeda leader that's killed by a drone attack. And from the U.S. government point of view, that might be acceptable collateral damage. But from the point of view of Pakistan and the population there, that's entirely unacceptable. We're talking about huge numbers of people who are being killed. And, you know, the population as a whole doesn't see it as a acceptable sacrifice.
And so we have these really severe attacks by the U.S. on Muslim countries. And yet the way that it's portrayed in the U.S. is that the Muslims are the ones who are really dangerous. And if you look at, like, statistically, your chances of getting killed by a terrorist, they're, you know, you've got more of a chance of getting hit by lightning. But we have this hysteria that's been whipped up.
That's correct. And, you know, take the example of Afghanistan and the areas of Pakistan where we're conducting drone attacks. The estimate by the U.S. government itself is that there are about 100 al-Qaeda. These are the folks that we're going after, most assiduously. So in other words, we're spending we spent about $1 trillion over the last decade on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we're spending, tens of millions of dollars per person to try to get these al-Qaeda terrorists. Now, there's no question that al-Qaeda is dangerous. There's no question that al-Qaeda wants to attack the United States. The question is whether our strategy in going after al-Qaeda is effective.
Well, wait a minute. I would like to examine that statement that mm-hmm. al-Qaeda is really dangerous and is really after the United States, mm-hmm. because it kind of is put out there without any examination. And if you look at the difference in the amount of funding and firepower between the U.S. and these Muslim guys, I mean, it just seems like it's so overblown.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree entirely. The question for me is the proportionate response as well as the strategy of dealing with al-Qaeda. By going to war with Afghanistan and Iraq, and even the U.S. government admits this, we've essentially turned these wars into a kind of recruitment campaign for al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has swelled in membership, not in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but in other parts of the world, for instance, in Saudi Arabia and now Yemen.
How do we know that? Like, is there some kind of membership list for al-Qaeda that, that you know, we can go in and check and say, hey, you know, they signed up 50 people today?
Mm-hmm. The information we have, for instance, about Saudi Arabia and Yemen largely comes from our cooperation with Saudi Arabian government, which, a lot of people complain about Saudi Arabia exporting its version of Wahhabism and fundamentalism. But in fact, Saudi Arabia has been one of our key allies in fighting against al-Qaeda, because al-Qaeda is as much of a threat to Saudi Arabia as it is to any other country. So Saudi Arabia has provided us with information about membership in at least in what's called Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula.
And they would, of course, have no political reason for upping those numbers.
Well, they have tremendous reason to up those numbers. But the bottom line is whether we're talking about Yemen or Iraq, for instance, Al-Qaeda still represents a political force there. While, again, I argue that our response to Al-Qaeda has not been the proper one, I think, frankly, we should be approaching this issue from a criminal point of view rather than a war point of view. I wouldn't deny that it exists and that it has a coherent ideology, and that ideology is, generally speaking, anti-American, anti-Western. Again, the question for me is how we deal with that, not to exaggerate the threat, and certainly not to assume that this Al-Qaeda ideology is shared even by the other political Islamic organizations, whether we're talking about Hezbollah or Hamas or even the Taliban, much less the much broader Muslim community. We're talking about more than a billion people. Vast majority. I mean, the Al-Qaeda appeals to an infinitesimal number of those folks.
And this idea that there's a huge difference between the extreme radicals in groups like Al-Qaeda and the vast majority of Muslims around the world is, I think, this essential part of the Islamophobia. But this isn't something new. This idea goes back a very long way.
It does. We could go back as far as the 11th century, for instance, when the First Crusade was launched in Europe against the Turks and Arabs and the Muslim world in the Holy Land, an attempt to recapture Jerusalem. There was a belief at that time that all of Islam was, predisposed against Europe, against Christianity. And there was, of course, some history to that. I mean, the Islamic forces had, in the 8th century, several hundred years before, had taken over parts of Spain, parts of Italy. But by the time of the 12th century, in fact, or the 11th century, rather, that kind of unity of the Islamic world no longer existed, and that attempt to kind of spread the caliphate further no longer existed. So even in the 11th century, in order to kind of generate enthusiasm to go on a crusade, the proto-Europeans and the Pope and several princes basically created an imaginary Islam, an Islam that was still bent on taking over the world, an Islam that was unified around a coherent ideology, when in fact that wasn't the case. So that kind of creation of a mythic Islam is part of the very creation of Europe and the very creation of Western civilization, and it's still with us today.
Well, the irony is that they were using this idea of this bloodthirsty Muslim hordes to drum up support for wars that were actually, the Crusades weren't actually all against Muslims.
That's correct. I mean, for instance, with the First Crusade, when the Crusaders were being brought together, the knights and in some cases farmers who took up arms, on their way to the Holy Land, because they basically walked there, many of them said, well, why are we going all the way to the Crusades to fight the Islam, when we could fight the real enemies of Christianity? And from their point of view, the real enemies of Christianity were Jews. And so the First Crusades were filled with pogroms against Jews in Germany and other places along the route to the Holy Land. And that became a feature, actually, of the Crusades, these pogroms against Jews in Europe. Another enemy of the Crusaders were rebel Christians. These were later the heretics that formed the enemy of the Crusaders, and which later would become the basis of the Inquisition. And then finally, there were the Byzantine Christians that the Crusaders went up against as well, a kind of rival to Rome. So the Crusades was not just the cross against the Crescent, the Christians against the Muslims. It actually was an enormously varied struggle between Western Catholics and a variety of enemies.
But it did consolidate power in the Catholic Church and spread Christianity.
That's correct. Absolutely. And in a sense, the Crusades was the first defining moment for Europe. Before the Crusades, Europe didn't exist as an entity, but the Crusades gave it shape. And of course, it gave it shape in a particular way. It gave Europe the shape of basically a force that was aligned against Islam. And this is such a powerful kind of notion at the heart of European identity that, for instance, when Turkey, the country Turkey, applies for membership in the European Union, you get this enormous negative reaction throughout Europe from France, from Germany. Why? Because they're worried about the Turkish economy, they're worried about Turkish political structure or its foreign policy. No, the major reason is because Turkey is majority Muslim, and they don't see a majority Muslim country as being part of the European Union.
Okay, and this is Talk Radio. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest is John Pfeffer, and we're talking about Islamophobia. Give us a call and join the conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Well, it seems that in Europe, there's been a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment, but most of that seems to be targeted towards Muslims.
That's correct. The Islamophobia we see here in the United States is very different from the Islamophobia experienced in Europe. Here in the United States, it's largely addressed toward a kind of mythic Islam. The Muslim American population here is extremely well educated, extremely well integrated into the United States, has very high employment levels and salaries. So, generally speaking, the Islamophobia here doesn't strike at kind of identity issues of what American identity is. Islamophobia in Europe is quite different. It strikes at the very kind of conception of what is European. Muslim population has grown quite dramatically over the last decade or so. And in part, it's because of a demographic issue in Europe. The birth rates in most European countries have fallen. The European countries no longer have enough people to work the jobs. And a tremendous number of Muslims from around the world, from Turkey, from North Africa, have come to Europe and are working in the jobs that Europeans no longer want to do or can do. And that has created a tremendous amount of tension over the future of European identity. So, for instance, in Germany, politicians will say, we're worried that Germany will still be Germany in the future. Remember, these are countries that don't identify themselves as immigrant countries, as the way the United States identifies itself. So the notion of what is German, what is French, is highly contested. And so the Muslim populations there challenge the notion of Germany being, kind of Teutonic, or French being, based on pure French language and lineage thousands of years ago that goes back to France of yore. So this is the kind of the difference between the Islamophobias.
Okay, and we're going to take some listener calls. Okay, Joe, good morning.
Well, good morning. Hey, so I was wondering if I could ask the guest, what does he, especially here in America, what does he attribute the percentage of Islamophobia that has to do with religion and Christianity, et cetera, et cetera? And how much of it is just really looking for a scapegoat or a whipping boy. Strong hierarchical countries really need to have their victim class?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And I would also say that to add on to the kind of scapegoat question, the specific rise of Islamophobia in the last couple of months, you could argue, was related very closely to the elections, that kind of extremists on the right wing saw an opportunity to tar the Democrats and Obama with this issue. So, for instance, as you, I'm sure, know, there's speculation that Obama was a closet Muslim, that he was never born in the United States. And this was speculation, of course, that took place during the campaign, but it resurfaced again over the summer. It was used deliberately as a tactic to undermine the Democrats. The raising of the issue of the mosque and the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, an Islamic center located a couple of blocks from Ground Zero. Again, this was something that had been praised by even right-wing Republicans as a good thing, that this was going to be an interfaith center led by a moderate Muslim. But then, again, over the summer, it was turned completely on its head. And you could argue that it was done so for very specific political reason, that it had nothing to do with, an overall attack on religion, but it had a very specific political content to raise this issue at a difficult time for the Democrats and to make it an electoral issue that would benefit the Republicans.
It has this flavor of, it has Rove written all over it, because it's this highly emotional issue that has nothing to do with the fundamental problems the U.S. is facing. And yet, by use of this kind of innuendo and whisper campaigns, it managed to get a whole bunch of people all riled up.
Exactly. You could connect this to a much larger campaign that has been taking place within kind of extremists on the Republican Party to conflate two terms, and that is Islam and Islamism. President Bush, for all of his defects, at least spent a lot of time distinguishing between the two. And Bush, made a point of going to mosques, of reaching out to Muslim community here in the United States. Didn't do so well overseas, but at least domestically, he tried to do that. He was always very careful to say, well, there are Islamic extremists, and then there is Islam. But if you look at the statements of, major media figures like Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly, they're constantly saying that Islam itself is a violent religion, that the problem is not with extremist Islam, it's with Islam itself. And this, there's a tradition that goes back hundreds of years of arguing that Islam is inherently a violent religion. That we could go into some depth about why that's not the case, or, why if you read, the Old Testament, you could say that Judaism is inherently a violent religion. Very controversial kind of reading. But
And Christianity. And we're going
to
take another listener call. John, good morning.
Hi, how are you? That's an interesting discussion. However, I think you're ignoring the fact that Islam, unlike certainly the doctrines of Christianity as opposed to the doctrines of the states that have been in Christianity, had a violent beginning, and it was spread by the sword and fire all across the remains of the empires that they conquered when they began in the 700s, and they went all the way to Spain, and then there was another phase of expansion, which had to do with the Ottoman Empire, which devastated Central Europe, and where the residue of that are things like Bosnia. And so the problem is that Islam was quiescent for a couple hundred years when the West had a technological superiority, starting in about 1800 with the invasion of Napoleon in Egypt, and then the British and French incursions into the Arabic world and the Muslim world. But now it seems as though they have revived, and in fact, They are at war in any state where you have a 20-30% Islamic population. There is armed conflict. You could go to Nigeria, the Sudan, Malaysia, the Philippines, Kashmir, India, and Pakistan. And so the fact is that there is nothing contradictory in fundamental Islamic doctrine with being at war with your neighbors. And in fact, they have a doctrine which says the rule of the realm of peace is where Islam prevails. And in those countries, you know, you have 90% Islamic populations and very limited rights for anybody else.
Well, you know, let's take a look at, first of all, where you started out this line of thinking was that Islam was spread by the sword. But isn't that also true of Christianity?
Well, no, it's not true of Christianity. Read the doctrine of Jesus Christ. Christianity was a religion of the underdogs in the Roman Empire, and they were a peaceful religion. They were persecuted. They were slaughtered in the Colosseum. And then in the 300-400s, they became the state religion of Rome. And at that point, attacked various pagan groups and converted them. That was mostly in Eastern Europe, Lithuania and so forth. And they were on the defensive against the Muslims who were attempting to conquer all the Christian lands. I mean, don't you guys read any history?
So, John,
read a lot of history. And you
well,
get
I don't, I think,
peculiar
you, I think you're,
view
you're
of
missing
this,
a lot of what's going on
Christianity
here.
Itself, with the sword, just as other religions have. If you've read the Old Testament, you realize that Judaism, too, spread itself by the sword. This is a fundamental interpretation that leaders and military people have made of religion. I think if you look at countries like Turkey today, you find that this is a democratic country. It has a thriving economy, and it is majority Muslim. Over 90% of the people in Turkey are of Islamic faith. You can't say that Turkey is, you know, is the kind of caricature of an Islamic country that you presented. There is a variety of different Islamic groupings. There's a variety of different Islamic political groups. There are a variety of different Islamic countries. To call all of that, you know, one extremist version of the religion is incorrect.
And when we're also talking about Christianity being spread by the sword, we have to remember what happened in the New World. It would be interesting if we had some callers who were Native Americans to talk a little bit about how Christianity has looked to the Native American community. And the phone number is 503-231-8187. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest is John Pfeffer, and we're talking about Islamophobia. I think the other point that the caller brought up was the idea that there's all this conflict in the Muslim countries. But if you start looking at the history of these conflicts, a lot of it revolves around the Western countries coming in for resource extraction in these countries.
That's correct. I mean, certainly the borders, which we call the bloody borders of Islam, that's what the term that Samuel Huntington used, are in fact often the bloody borders of colonialism. These are the borders that colonial powers established. They were usually arbitrary. And the conflicts that we see today, whether in the Middle East or Africa, in some parts of Asia, result from these colonial era disagreements between groups that found themselves on either side of the border. A lot of the conflicts revolve around resources. Certainly the issue in the Middle East is energy, raw materials in Africa. Religion, you know, plays a certain role as an overlay, but it often is not the fundamental root of these conflicts.
And yet, the way it's being presented in the mainstream media in the United States, the point of view that our recent caller had is absolutely promoted over and over again. The idea that somehow all Muslims are following an inherently violent religion.
That's right. It's emphasized not only by kind of, as I said, the right-wing radio talk show hosts or TV personalities, but it permeates the kind of mainstream presentation of what Islam is like. We get very few kind of positive portrayals. To go back to Turkey for a moment, I read all the time of how the AKP, which is the government that is in control in Turkey, is an Islamist party, when in fact it's not an Islamist party at all. It's not an Islamic party. There are some members of the party that were part of an Islamic party in the past, but this current party is very clearly designed as a Western-oriented party that wanted to bring Turkey into the European Union, that has kind of made tremendous gains economically for the country, which has done a tremendous amount politically in terms of bringing power away from the military and investing it into secular institutions. To call this an Islamist party, which is, you know, a tag you often find in even reputable journals, is completely a distortion of what's taking place in that country.
Okay, and we're going to take another caller. Oh, and this is anonymous. Okay.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm finding as I get older that the United States of America, which I've been born and bred here and raised here and have kids here, I've been finding that our society is sociopathic. It's plain and simple. There's no, I mean, we as a society are so mind screwed through the manipulation of television and the religious figures on TV who are doing things in God's name, like ripping off old people that can't even get up to get their checkbooks because they had open heart surgery to buy fake, you know, vitamins that are being marketed over the telephone to them. And then what we have is we have this religion and we have this media, and they're pushing these agendas to generalize a form of religion like Islam, or let's talk about the indigenous American. What kind of things did they do to the indigenous American in a religion name? They came and wiped out all the buffalo to kill out the indigenous American. The term Washington Redskins, I don't know if you know where this came from, but what happened was they actually put a bounty on the indigenous Americans. They brought him over and skinned him alive, and then they sold his skin to people in religion on the East Coast, and they wore them as clothing. And then what they did is they took the genitalia skin of the children and they wore them as rubber bands in their hair. Now, this is what we're still dealing with today from George Bush saying you can waterboard and take children into prison and for crimes at 6 years old, 14 years old, or whatever it is. So I think what we're doing, we're seeing a sociopathic process that media and the hierarchy in our society, the 1% of whatever's running the world, is putting and instilling into our children through marketing of products. So this whole thing really goes deep into the programming of the children, and it's been being done for 200 years or more. And so I really think that we have to deal with the media, and that is really the foundation of what is the problem, because if we took the media and took all the programming away and put in love, shows about love, compassion, wisdom, and understanding, and sustainability, conservation, we would see society flip upside down.
But that wouldn't sell lots of weapons.
Well, and that's, again, that is sold through the media under these video games, you know, in the money. And again, we have to then change the way money works, right?
Yes, but so, if we're not afraid, very afraid of something, doesn't the whole the kind of structure fall apart here?
Well, and that's part of the religion thing. They want you to be afraid. Isn't the whole Bible all about fear? If you do this or do that, you're going to rot in hell and burn. If you, you know, here, you know, so it really is the foundation of what we're feeding our children. I was driving down Martin Luther King the other day in front of the new Planned Parenthood. There's little children, 8, 10 years old, holding signs of babies that have been aborted that have no clue what they're talking about and what they're holding up the signs. But the parents themselves have manipulated the child to go and do its dirty work for them.
Okay.
So we really have to find it. We have to get through the sociopathic mentality. We have to get through the algorithms of mentality because they're all brainwashed through this media that takes them into a coma state. And we have to feed them knowledge and inspiration and compassion, and then we could see a change in how society deals with things. I mean, how can you take the genitalia of a child and then wear it as rubber bands and walk around and feel like you're something? I mean, how do you do that? And so, and that is in our children today. And so really, we've got to change television. And thank you for the show.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. And
maybe I could just add one thing to that. I think at some deep level, there is a tremendous anxiety about these crimes that we've committed as a civilization. And that anxiety is reflected in what we project on to other people. And so, for instance, you know, we say that Islam is committed to taking over the world. But in fact, that reflects our own anxiety or perhaps our guilt about our attempts in the past to take over the world, take over the world of North America, take over the world of Africa. And it reflects our anxiety about our interventions, our military interventions today. When we say that Islam is inherently violent, we're concerned at some deep level about the violence in our own past, the violence, again, of the Crusades, of the New World slaughters. So I think, you know, this mirror imaging is a kind of a representation of what the caller is talking about. We don't recognize it at a formal level, at a conscious level, but I think it's there deep down, and this is the way it comes out.
Okay, and we're going to take another caller now. Good morning, Lee.
Yes, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Hey, man, live long and forever for the information, brother. I appreciate it. It's a hell of a country. It's a hell of a world. You know that. What you were talking about earlier, I was thinking about Muhammad Ali. Prior to that, his name was Cassius Clay. And when he converted from Christianity to Islam, you know, really nothing really changed because America was America. And so, therefore, it was like, man, you're going to be treated black from the East Coast to the West Coast, no matter if it was Cassius Clay or it was Muhammad Ali. So you're making a great point right there that this thing is deeper than just this religious thing. It's deeper than that. It goes to the very core of what the thinking is of man towards man.
Well,
and you hit it right on the head.
And also, you know, if you want to talk about Christianity being a violent religion, let's take a look at the way slavery was justified through Christianity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, please. I mean, we don't even have to go there. It took me a few years just to even accept that I wanted to read a Bible or anything like that, because as I got more knowledge and understanding of how the blacks were manipulated by individuals who claim to have this Christian attitude, and you bless a slave as you forcibly take him into another country, and then if he does anything wrong against the slave master, you know the story, he can be disemboweled. And the slave master himself would be totally exonerated, and he has the keys to heaven, and et cetera, et cetera. It's a bunch of crap. The Islam thing is the same thing, because anything and everything is going to be rooted out. You know that. I know that. It really is a spiritual warfare, but you got cats who are religious or think they're religious and think they know how to run this world. And they manipulated this whole thing. Obama, poor dude. He's going to go out with all this crap on him. You know it and I know it, because they've done a masterful job of putting out the lie. My mama used to say, a liar get there before the truth. So keep up the work, man, giving these people some knowledge so you won't go to the grave totally ignorant.
Okay, well, thanks for your call, Lee.
Just to give another example, Malcolm X was very impressed with, when he went on Hajj in Saudi Arabia, he was very impressed at all the different varieties of folks who were part of the world of Islam. I mean, it was one of the kind of important reaffirmations for him, for his Islamic faith, that Islam was such an accepting religion in terms of black and brown and white. For him especially, it was interesting to sit down with white folks with blue eyes and share information about Islam. However, when he was interviewed by Saeed Ramadan in Geneva, and Saeed Ramadan said, well, isn't Islam enough? I mean, why are you working on anything other than spreading the faith? And Malcolm X said, I still have to work on struggle for black people in the United States and globally. That is part of my work. Islam is important, but this is also important. So it was a kind of interesting look inside the world of Islam and the challenge of being an African-American in that world.
And one thing I want to say here, I don't want this, it seems like we're doing a lot of Christian bashing, but the thing is I don't want anyone to see any religion as painted either black or white, that there's extremists in just about every religion who do things that are really not good, and we have to be accepting of the good part of all kinds of religions. Anyway, we're going to go to another caller.
Let me just add to that, and that is when you talked about slavery, who were the folks who led the anti-slavery movement in England in the early 19th century? It was Quakers. It was Christians. So, you know, there was an element within Christianity which was very much opposed to slavery. So as you're right, there is extremism and there are very profound transformational movements within religions as well.
Okay, good morning, Bob.
Hi. The only thing I really know about slavery is my ancestors were Irish, and we came over here as an indentured servant, so we're kind of in the same boat, figuratively and literally. But I was calling because I have questions. I don't know that much about Islam. I know that someone that I respect quite a bit said that the most quoted prophet in the Quran was Jesus. And I know that I was raised Christian Baptist, but my papa is Baha'i, which is Persian faith. You know, Jesus is the only way to God, and they believe that each prophet speaks a language specifically created by God for that particular group of people, and that there are that many paths to God. But I know that the state at the time of Jesus co-opted his ideas and stole church power to promote their own purposes, just like I'm seeing right now these talk show hosts on the radio on the right talking like they're children of God and they're speaking venomous hate. And we were warned to beware the false prophet in the Bible and that the only sin is thinking that you are God. And so I was wondering if you could show some parallels between real Christians who fear the lie and seek the truth. And if there's parallels in Islamic beliefs that, yeah, there's extremists because they're listening to idiots spewing venomous hate instead of actually praying for God to show them what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of open-ended, but I was wondering if you could cover that a bit, and I'll take it off the air. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Sure. Well, one of the kind of myths of the post-9/11 era is that the Islamic community did not condemn the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. In fact, the Muslim community here in the United States and internationally very, very strongly condemned those attacks. And a number of members of the community, you know, went into some serious soul-searching about this. And, you know, they stepped forward and they took courageous stands. That included, you know, organizations like CAIR, C-A-I-R, here in the United States. It included the Organization of Islamic Conference, which is the largest collection of Islamic countries in the world. And they didn't do it just after 9/11. They have done it repeatedly after terrorist attacks and even when there haven't been terrorist attacks. And they've been very clear. These people, the terrorists, have claimed that they are fighting under the banner of Islam, and they are not. These attacks are antithetical to the Islamic tradition. So there are folks, specifically when we related it to the terrorism issue, but you also see a kind of transformation, I think, within Islam on other issues as well, and very interesting developments in Europe, in the Middle East, where Islamic movements are coming to terms with democracy, participating in democratic elections, coming to terms with modern economies. It was once asserted, for instance, that the reason why the Islamic world was impoverished in comparison to the West was because there was something inside Islam itself that made it impossible for these countries to advance economically. But you can't make that argument any longer. Turkey, Indonesia, both of which are predominantly Muslim countries, are now in the top 16 countries in the world in terms of their economy. Tremendous economic growth, and some of that explicitly linked to Islam. In Turkey, for instance, there's a phenomenon called the Islamic Calvinists in central Anatolia, a group of businessmen who basically are using Islam in the same way that businessmen in the 18th, 19th century used Calvinism as a kind of spur to economic development. So some very interesting trends that go against the myth that, first of all, Islam did not, people within Islam did not condemn terrorism, and the myth that Islam somehow retards economic and political development.
Okay, and we're going to get another caller in here. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Interesting conversation and appreciate it. The one thing I wanted to add, or I think is kind of interesting, is I'm a big fan of Daniel Quinn, who wrote the book Ishmael and the Story of B. And in those books, which are both fiction, but what he talks about is how the world's religions, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, Judaism, all have a root, and a very common root, in our civilization culture. Prior to 10,000 years ago, the world universally had one religion. He calls it animism, and that was the world, the religion indigenous people practiced. They each little incident of it would have been different, but for the most part, they all believed in the animation of the things around us, the trees, the world, all those things. And then along comes civilization, and in a very short period of time speaking, you have all these religions pop up that are essentially sky gods, and there's a kind of a mindset underlying all of them, and that is that the world was made for man, and man was meant to rule it. And so the thing I just wanted to kind of add is, I know there's differences between each of these religions, but at the same time, the similarity and how they contribute to our current world is pretty amazing. And I loved what he was just saying, how Islam's morphing to be in line with global capitalism and the destruction of the planet. Let's work harder, exploit more resources, and get rich, because that's God's mission for us, is kind of what I, paraphrasing what I just heard, some people in Kurdistan are just doing. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that point up, and because I see these religions really as part of a symptom of a deeper root problem, and also really, really down at a deep root. They're all the same, and they work to deliver us somehow salvation on this planet that right now is such a mess because of the way we're living. And just I'll listen off the air, and thanks for having this show.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. And it's been a really interesting conversation, but this is community radio, so we get to talk about things in a way that other places don't. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Voices of the Middle East, Reese Ehrlich discusses his book, Conversation with Terrorists. At 10, Air Cascadia is got headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report on the cholera outbreak in Haiti and a report on protecting Social Security. At 11, on the digital divide, the guests are Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and Lee Ann Coleman, owner of Pest Detection Northwest, talks about the science of bed bug sniffing dogs. You're listening to Talk Radio. I'm Marianne Barasonic. My guest is John Pfeffer. Sorry. And he is the co-director of the Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Study. And we're talking about Islamophobia. So let's take a call here. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. This is one of the best shows I've heard on KBOO.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, as a born-again Christian, I find it interesting. I'm not Islamophobic. I do believe in the Bible, and I do believe that Christianity is not necessarily a religion, although you can put it into that category. But Christianity is a relationship, and that's one thing I want to clarify with the cable listeners, is it is a relationship with a man called Jesus Christ who came from heaven, died on the cross, rose again, and incidentally, the only, call it a religious leader, who ever died and rose again, Muhammad, Buddha, Allah, all these were leaders, but they all died, and they're still dead today, so that's why Christianity is more of a relationship with Jesus Christ, and whether you believe it or not, it is the only way to heaven. But you said something interesting earlier. You said that every religion has its extremes, and I believe that's true. There are people in Christianity who take it to extremes who I oppose, because Christianity is a religion or a relationship of love, people who are trying to reach out to the lost and show them the way, which is the only way to Jesus Christ and to heaven. And it's not that Christianity is against people or says that if you do something wrong or if you don't accept Jesus Christ in your heart, you will go to hell. Hell is the byproduct of not accepting a better life and a better life after death. It a lot of people think of God as, oh, he's going to punish you if you do something wrong. No, I would tend to look at it more as, if you live a godly life and follow Jesus Christ, eternal life awaits you that is beyond what we can imagine.
But there is people who call themselves Christians who do very violent things.
You know what? I agree with that. And the Muslims, you have radical Muslims, you have radical Buddhists, you've always had a sect of radicalism in any religion. I agree with you. We're human beings, and some people take it to extremes. But do we throw Christianity out as a whole?
Well,
that's what I'm trying to say. I agree with your statement.
Okay. Well, John, what's your take on this?
Well, my own religious background is Judaism, and I don't currently practice any religion. My attitude generally is that folks have different ways to enlightenment, and that should be respected. I tend to believe what the previous caller was talking about in terms of, the need to look at things sustainably, that religions have many, especially monotheistic religions, tend to be relatively hierarchical, that they are often intolerant of other kind of perspectives, and that in order for us to get along on this planet, we're going to have to be not only more tolerant, but actually empathize with other people, not only kind of just tolerate their points of view, but actually engage them, understand where they're coming from. That's the only way we're going to be able to accommodate so many people on this planet. And we have to do that at a time of environmental crisis, which imposes certain limits on what we can do economically. In that kind of an environment, any kind of notion of exclusivity that one group has the truth as the way to enlightenment, that's that's not going to doesn't pose a very good strategy for kind of global coexistence.
Okay, and good morning, Dan. What's your take on this?
Yeah, oh boy, I'm not going to have time to. There are so many distorted things that have been said in this hour, and so I tried to think of a basic principle, maybe that people can that might clear up a lot of things if people think about it, and that's this: that any religion, because there's been a lot of criticism of different things going down, that to know what a religion is, you need to look at what the founder said. And what the first, what the origin, you know, the original meaning of the religion is, not what people did hundreds and thousands of years later. That's meaningless. I mean, it's not meaningless, you know, in history. But I mean, as far as when you identify something as a certain religion, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, you need to look at what did Buddha teach? What did Christ teach? What did Christ's apostles teach? What did Muhammad teach? What did the Quran say? That is what the religion is. What people did 1,000 years later is absolutely meaningless as far as what the religion is, because people can do whatever they want, and they can put any sticker on their car or on their, you know, call themselves anything they want. And I just find that people forget that all the time, and it's been forgotten for the whole entire hour, just about. So all kinds of ridiculous things have been said during this hour. So I suggest that if people want to know what Christianity is, that they read the New Testament, not the Old Testament, the New Testament. If they want to know what Islam is, read and look at the Quran, look what Muhammad did. And, you know, I mean, he led caravan raids. They would raid people's caravans, Muhammad's people. They would raid caravans, steal their stuff, kill the people. Muhammad married a 9-year-old girl named Aisha. The 10 years after Muhammad died, his followers slaughtered each other trying to be the leader of the group. Jesus' 12 apostles did not do that, if
okay.
you noticed.
Okay, well, yeah. We have come to the end of the hour. Thank you very
yeah.
much for your call, Dan.
Okay.
And John, I want to thank you for being my guest. You've been listening to Talk Radio. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest has been John Pfeffer, co-director of the Foreign Policy in Focus of the Institute of Policy Studies